Then indeed the Bodhisattva Ruchiraketu slept. In the middle of his sleep he saw a golden drum made of gold, shining everywhere just like the orb of the sun. And in all the directions he saw innumerable, incalculable Buddhas, sitting on beryl seats at the foot of jewelled trees, surrounded and honoured in an assembly of numerous hundreds of thousands, teaching the Dharma. And there he saw a man with the form of a Brahmin beating that drum. There, from the sound of the drum, he heard confessional verses coming forth. As soon as he awoke, he recollected these verses of confession of the Dharma. At the end of that night, he departed from Rajagriha with numerous hundreds of thousands of beings. He came to Mount Gridrakuta where the Lord was, and having approached and worshipped the feet of the Lord with his head, he thrice walked round the Lord towards the right and sat down at one side. Sitting on one side, the Bodhisattva Ruchiraketu placed his hands together in reverence towards the Lord and uttered those confessional verses that he had heard in the middle of his sleep from the sound of the drum. One night, when I was not tired, I fell asleep and saw a gleaming drum with a golden light everywhere. Shining like the sun, it beamed everywhere. It glowed in the ten directions. I saw Buddhas everywhere. I saw one in the form of a Brahmin beating the drum, and while it was being struck by him, these verses came forth. By the excellent drum of the golden light, may the suffering in the triple thousand world be extinguished. So this is the beginning of chapter 3 of the Sutra of Golden Light, immediately following on from Ruchiraketu's vast vision of the Buddhas and their revelation of the immeasurable length of life of the Buddha. And immediately after this, he falls asleep. He falls asleep even though, he says, he was not tired. And Bhante's comment on Ruchiraketu's sleep is this. He said, "It's no ordinary sleep. It represents the complete erasure, the complete obliteration, the complete blotting out of the old self, the old consciousness. In Shakespeare's phrase, it is the sleep of death. Not the sleep of physical death, it's the sleep of spiritual death. The death that comes when we've abandoned all previous conditions. If we want to develop spiritually, we must die. If we want to be completely transformed, as distinct from merely peripherally transformed, we must die." You may have heard of the Tibetan Book of the Dead as the Bardo Todol is known as in the West. The Sutra of Golden Light is also a book of the dead. Every Buddhist scripture is a book of the dead, because every Buddhist scripture wants us to be transformed. The sutra is the agent, the instrument of transformation. If we are not prepared to die, we cannot be a bodhisattva. We cannot be a Buddhist. And we have to be prepared to experience spiritual death at any time. We have to be ready at any time to give up the old life, the old self, the old consciousness. We have to be ready to forget the old problems and the old solutions. We have to be ready to make a completely fresh start. Otherwise, we cannot be totally transformed. Very strong words from Bhante, from Sangharakshita, I think you'll agree, given in a public lecture, I made in Hampstead Town Hall all those years ago. I mean, you know, clearly no concern about making it easier for the man on the street, but of course it appealed to many. And as you probably know, if you've been around the Triratna for a while, you know that there's this system of meditation, these stages of spiritual practice that Sangharakshita has pointed to, and two of these are spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. These occur in his system of Dharma life. Ordination is seen as a spiritual death and a spiritual rebirth. Ordination is a going forth from the known to the unknown. You're giving up, when you're ordained, your worldly life. You're giving up your old name, even. You're being spiritually reborn and you're entering into a new life. You're given a new name that indicates that life. At the time of ordination, you're given a new meditation practice. You're formally introduced to the Buddha or Bodhisattva that you have a deep connection with, which is, Sangharakshita says, is you at the end of the path. You're contemplating yourself transformed. You as you will be if you're prepared to die and be reborn. This is the significance of ordination. It's a fresh start, and it's very important to understand this. Very important for order members to understand it. It's very easy to forget this, even when you're an order member. Very important that you understand this, those of you who've asked to be ordained, who want to be ordained. And when we speak like this, well, it's really no wonder that there is confession. Confession, it's no wonder why confession plays such an important part in the Buddhist life. And as I said yesterday, the chapter on confession in the Sutra of Golden Light is really the central part of the sutra. It's the nucleus of the sutra. Everything, in a way, turns on the verses of confession. It's regarded as the heart of the sutra, the nucleus of its spiritual energy. And what's really fascinating is that the confessional verses pour forth in a dream. They happen in a dream, no ordinary dream. A dream, of course, that is about spiritual death and rebirth, that is about transformation. This isn't unusual in Buddhist tradition for significant spiritual experiences and breakthroughs to occur in the dream state. There are many stories of great Buddhists making significant spiritual progress in dreams. In dreams, you can encounter Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. You can receive direct teachings from them. You can enter profound meditative states in dreams. I think when I look at it, some of my most important experiences have happened in dreams, not in the waking state, when the usual mind is suspended and something entirely different opens up. And dreams which have had a significant impact on my life generally. In dreams you can even travel to pure Buddha fields and receive teachings from the different Buddhas. Some of you might be a bit sceptical about this, but if you are, that might well be your very materialistic worldview, which you've yet to really deal with. No doubt much could be said about the dream state as a place of Dharma practice, but our main concern in this talk is with the theme of confession. In his dream, Ruchiraketu sees a great golden drum, which is like the orb of the sun. A great golden drum, like the orb of the sun, whose light fills the whole of space. There are Buddhas everywhere, surrounded by hundreds of thousands, and all are teaching, all communicating the Dharma. No doubt it's got the sound like a sort of mantra going on, the great sound of reality. It's no ordinary teaching, it's the sort of drone of reality, sort of primal sound, perhaps. Well, this seems to be Ruchiraketu's encounter with that transcendent golden light. We've already observed, or following Sangharakshita, that the golden light is beyond all description. It doesn't shine from anywhere. Doesn't have a source. It's without beginning, middle, and end. Okay. But it will, of course, take significant form when it comes into the realm of subject and object, when it comes into the realm of embodiment, when it makes an encounter with us. It will manifest in the most significant and of meaningful forms. It will take, if you like, form in the most significant symbols and myths for the individual who is encountering the golden light. For Ruchira Ketu, it manifests as a great sun drum. A great golden sun drum. No doubt this drum has great significance for Ruchira Ketu and for the Buddhists of his time, of his age. This is why myth and symbol and story are so very important. The transcendental, as it were, when it meets us, it will meet us through symbol, significant myth, symbol, story, and image in the realm of undefined and undefinable meaning. So, another huge topic that we could go into, but it's as if that realm beyond all description clothes itself in significant form that will touch us on our very, very deepest level. And in this dream, Ruchira Ketu sees a man in the form of a Brahmin beating that drum over and over, and as he beats the drum, the verses pour forth. And Bhante's comments on the significance of the Brahmin, I think, are very interesting. He insists that the Brahmin here is not meant in the caste sense, in the Indian caste sense, as the so-called highest of caste. He conjectures that perhaps the Brahmin is in the form of what the Brahmin originally was, the shaman of the tribe, the one who mediates between the gods and the spirits and men, who would go off alone sometimes with his drum and be taken up by the gods and the spirits and then come back to communicate the deeper meanings of things to the tribe. The Buddha himself, in the very earliest suttas, speaks of the enlightened man as the Brahmin. Again, not in the caste sense. The truly superior man, the true Brahmin, says the Buddha, is the man who goes off alone into the jungle, into the forest, is transported to other realms through their individual Dharma practice, in this case, the transcendental, and then brings it back for the people, communicates to the people. And it's interesting, the Buddha had to drop the use of the word Brahmin to describe the enlightened man because the caste meaning was far too strong. Had to just drop it. It just falls out of the Buddhist texts as you go on. But in the dream, the golden drum is being struck again and yet again. You know, there's just going to be this rhythm beating out. And as the drum is being beaten, as it's being struck, there comes forth a stream of verses. They just come pouring out. Just a bit on the symbolism of the drum. The Buddha, in the earlier scriptures again, speaks about the deathless drum. The drum of the deathless. He speaks about his attainment of enlightenment as the attainment of the amata, the deathless, the amrita. And when he speaks about teaching the Dharma, he talks about that he's going to beat on the drum of the deathless. This is what he says, I'm beating on the drum of the deathless. Amazing image, the drum of the deathless. It's the way he describes his Dharma teaching. His Dharma teaching, not giving a sermon, but beating on the drum of the deathless. And in Ruchirakaitu's dream, the deathless drum, the son of the golden light, is being beaten upon, and it speaks these verses. In the original Sutra of Golden Light, the verses really don't seem to be systematic. We've sort of systematized them a bit for our puja. But in the sutra, as you'd expect from a dream, they just come pouring out. And although they're called verses of confession, and there are many verses of confession, they aren't simply verses of confession. They're also verses of tremendous aspiration. Verses in which the bodhisattva vow is taken. Verses wanting the very, very best for all beings throughout the entire cosmos. Verses of devotion to the Buddha. Verses of rejoicing. It's like an early form of the puja, the sevenfold puja. But primarily, and mainly, they are verses of confession. And in Bhante's lecture on this, he mainly concentrates on confession. The original lecture is called The Spiritual Significance of Confession. And he looks at the topic of confession under six headings, which is what I'm going to do. I'm going to follow Bhante, although I'm going to, you know, put in a few other things. So the six headings are: who confesses? Secondly, to whom do they confess? Thirdly, what is confessed? Fourthly, what do you confess? Fifthly, how do you confess? And sixthly, the effects of confession. So first of all, who confesses? Well, in the sutra, the confession is made in a bodhisattva's dream. Okay, it's the drum making the confessional verses, beaten upon by the Brahmin. But of course, it's Ruchirakaitu's dream. And it's Ruchirakaitu who remembers the verses of confession and says them to the Buddha later. So we can say that who's confessing in the Sutra of Golden Light is Ruchirakaitu. It's a bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva is, of course, someone who's vowed to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. A bodhisattva is someone who is deeply committed to living the Dharma life, not just for themselves, but for the benefit of all. They can make that commitment. They can make that commitment to that life because they've really seen something. They've had a vision of what is possible for them, what is possible for all life. They've seen something, in other words, of the golden light. They've been touched by the golden light. They've seen the world touched by the golden light. That was reflected in the verses that I read right at the beginning about the excellent drum of the golden life. May all the sufferings of all beings be relieved. So it's very important to appreciate this. Confession, true confession, arises out of such vision, out of such inspiration, out of such commitment. Confession in Buddhism is not simply a sort of psychological exercise, a way of staying in with our particular group, or just to sort of make us feel, in a sense, a bit better. Confession arises out of our individual going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. In other words, confession arises because we see what is in the way, what restricts us, what hinders us. The golden light is revealing what hinders us to ourselves. So it's very, very important to appreciate. Confession happens within a very, very positive, expansive context. Confession arises because It's the golden light is showing us what is in the way. The Buddha is showing us what is in the way. I've been in many chapter meetings over the years, order meetings and so on. I've been involved in chapter meetings where there is confession, where there's a period at the beginning of the chapter where we confess our faults. And sometimes I think that inspiration, that real vision behind confession, gets lost sight of as we go over habitually the same old bad boring habits. I think that's more like admission. That's more like an admission. It's not really seeing the full significance of those faults. You have to see them in the context of the vision of the golden light. And you'll see this, if you like, the serious commitment to the golden light and the serious inspiration from the golden light is lacking when the confession is just that same old habitual stuff. So confession has to arise out of inspiration, out of vision. That's the first thing that we need to say. Secondly, to whom do we confess? Well, in Ruchirukyu's confession, the drum's confession is to the Buddhas, to the supreme Kalyanamitras, to the supreme spiritual friends. Ruchirukyu, of course, can see them. He's in touch with them. He knows them. He knows their qualities. He knows that they are indeed the best of beings and that they are full of mercy and compassion. He knows that they're supremely reliable, that they are a refuge, the refuge, and so they can give true protection. And we too can confess to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. We do this ritually in puja, and maybe at other times, you know, we can take our fault to them. But we don't often have that direct connection with the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas. Not usually. They're not usually living presences for us. So as well as doing the confession ritually, we will also need to confess our faults to living spiritual friends, to our Kalyanamitras, our horizontal Kalyanamitras, the ones on a similar level of experience to us, perhaps in our going for refuge groups, and to, of course, our Kalyanamitras, who are more, those more experienced in the Dharma than ourselves, people who we trust, people who we know, and they know us, and they listen well, they listen wisely, we're confident in that. If we confess our failings in the spiritual life to our worldly friends, to use that sort of phrase, or to our family members, they will probably wonder what our problem is. They'll probably suggest that we will lighten up and have another beer. But spiritual friends, if they are spiritual friends, will really listen. Really listen. Sometimes there's no need for them to say a word to us. We just know that their listening is enough to make the confession effective. But sometimes they might draw us out. They might feel that the confession maybe isn't quite full enough, isn't quite serious enough, that perhaps we're fudging just a little bit, maybe a lot. They might need to just pull on the threads a little bit, just to get it out a little bit more, the full significance of what's happening. There's a very interesting story in the Pali Canon where a monk confesses to the Buddha after being really quite alienated from the Buddha for a long time. And the Buddha's pleased that he's done that and that he's back. But then the Buddha says, and yes, do you really know the implications of what you've done? And he really spells it out for the monk, the full effect of his fault. Sometimes spiritual friends might even say, actually, I don't think that is a fault. I don't think that there is anything really unskillful in what you've done. I think there's other issues going on here. So in other words, you confess to other individuals who are practicing the Dharma, other individuals who are going for refuge. It's a very important feature of the early Buddhist spiritual community, when the monks would get together on their Uposatha days. Confession was the thing that they would do before they would recite the Pratimoksha, their basic code of ethics. And it's a feature of our chapter meetings, and I think even some going for refuge groups, when Sangharakshita sort of really relaunched the chapter system in our order back in the 1980s. He said he wanted a chapter meeting to be an ongoing spiritual workshop with a strong confessional element. An ongoing spiritual workshop with a strong confessional element, where you're really getting to grips with each other's Dharma life in full honesty, full transparency, really opening up to one another. He didn't explain that phrase. He'd left it to us to work out. We're still working out, I think, what it actually means. And there is some very good material on this. I think Subhuti's paper, Remorse and Confession in the Dharma Life and related material. I think our Going for Refuge group at Papaloka is studying that material at the moment, and they're finding it very beneficial, very useful for their own exploration of the Dharma together. So we confess to spiritual friends. Thirdly, what do we confess? And Bhante's comment on this is very simple, very direct. Everything. Everything. Everything that is holding us back. Everything that prevents us from developing. Everything that prevents us from gaining enlightenment. Nothing less than that. In the sutra, as in our own Sevenfold Puja, the word that describes this everything that holds us back is evil. Evil. And I know some people, probably some of you here, really don't like the use of this word, don't like the sound of it, and would really like another word to describe this everything. It has all sorts of associations that they find, you know, very unpleasant. And in any case, they would say, well, I've never done anything evil. I'm not a bad person. So why should we use that word? So let's just try and open up this word a little bit, see why it has to be there or why it's there. The original Sanskrit word, which is translated as evil, is papa. Papa. And you know, it really can't be translated in any other way. It's a really, really strong word in Sanskrit and indeed in contemporary Indian languages. It's bad. Bad. Badness. Bad juju. Bad stuff. Evil. Very strong word. Misfortune. It's got all that kind of connotation. It's the opposite of punya. Punya, which is usually translated as merit, but merit is a very, very weak translation. Punya is the good in the fullest and best sense. You know, the good vibes, you know, good force, good momentum, benefit, beneficial momentum. These words I'm using in English are so weak. The original Sanskrit is just so much stronger. So how can we look at this? Why are we using such a strong word when, you know, we're basically nice people who don't do evil things? Why are we using this such a strong word? Is it to make us feel really bad about ourselves and all that sort of thing? Let's try and look at it. First of all, we have to understand the traditional Buddhist context. The traditional Buddhist context, and it's reflected in the verses, is, of course, previous lives. When Ruchiraketu confesses, when the golden drum confesses, it's all the evil done that I've done from beginningless time. That's what's being confessed. Everything you've ever done in the whole of the stream of your conditioned existence, that's what's being vomited forth. So words, I'll say something more about being vomited a bit later. And I guess that the point here is that, well, if you're not enlightened, if you're not highly spiritually developed, well, there is a reason for that in the traditional context. It's not, you know, you've just been dealt a bad hand, you didn't have the best parents, you know, born in a bad time, didn't meet the Buddha, haven't got a very good teacher, etc., etc. No, you've done stuff. That's the Buddhist tradition. You've done stuff. You've done some seriously bad stuff in previous lives. I'm not saying this to make you all feel terribly guilty. I'm a bad person. I'm just trying to understand the traditional context as to why a word like evil would be used. It's because we've done stuff. If that's difficult to get hold of, and it will be, I understand that, because very few of us have that sense, genuine sense of previous lives, and very unlikely that this is going to be a viable, you know, way of practicing for you. Perhaps it could go something like this: why a word like evil could be used. If you really have a vision of what you could be, if you really are a bodhisattva with a vision of what you could be, a force for good in the world, and you have a real sense of that, you'll see that even the most minor fault, you'll see it as something very, very serious and very, very weighty. You'll see it because you'll see it as something restricting, hindering the good that you can do, the good that you can be in the world. So you'll regard that as really weighty, not just as a little bad fault, bad habit, but as evil, because it's really restricting the good that could come into this world. I remember a story which I've told many times before, but I make no apology for telling it again. It was a rebuke I received from an Indian order member. I worked in India for many years. Interestingly enough, the name of this order member is Amoghaditya, which means the unobstructed sun, the unobstructed golden light. And I was effectively Amoghaditya's Kalyanamitra. I lived with him and he was a Mitra. I was at his ordination. He was not a very educated man. He was a night watchman, for the Indian nuclear industry. It was the only work he could get. He was a village boy, a village man. He sort of forced himself to learn English so he could talk to me and communicate with me. He was a tremendous friend and supporter. I really felt his love for me. And we were on retreat together one time. And as sometimes happened with me in India, I had the bad habit of losing my temper when things went wrong. You know, things were late, or I felt I was being mucked about, or people weren't being particularly mindful, which could happen in India. And I lost it in an order meeting one evening, and I used, to my shame, some harsh speech, very rough speech. And at lunch the next day, Amoghaditya was sitting next to me, and we were eating. And he was very direct, Amoghaditya. And in his sort of slightly broken English, but, you know, the sheer force of his honesty, he said, "Padmavajra, you should not speak like this. You really should not speak like this." And I said, "Well, you know, come on. People have got to wake up," and, you know, waffled on. He said, "No. You should not speak like this." And he was really serious. "You should not speak like this," he said, "because when you speak like this, people will stay away from you and then you can't benefit them." I was silent. I mean, I could barely finish my dinner because it was true. It was true. He was saying, you can benefit people so much, but this habit will keep people away from you. So I would regard that as a serious fault. I would call that bad habit of losing my temper, of harsh speech, as evil, because it was restricting the good that I could do to benefit the people around me. The Buddha has a passage somewhere where he says, you need to see the danger in the most trifling faults. In the tiniest faults, there is danger in the tiniest of faults. Because tiny faults can become very large faults, can become even evil under certain conditions. We benefit enormously from stability, from a stable society, a stable civil society. We are free to meet, to practice the Dharma together, to go about our lives in a very, very straightforward way. We rarely have to come into conflict with people to do with the sheer matter of survival. Supposing we lived in a time of regime change. Supposing we lived in a world that suddenly became very dangerous, where there was civil war, where there was factionalism, where there was competition for resources, as it is in so many parts of the world. How would we be? How would we, us good Buddhists, how would we be if it was a matter of survival? How would we be, you know, if we had to protect our loved ones, if we had to protect ourselves, if we were competing for resources like food, water, shelter, clothing? I'm personally not confident that I wouldn't do some really serious things, serious evil, in order to protect myself, my friends, my family, my loved ones. My self-centeredness, my sheer survival instinct would so easily kick in. People do. Ordinary people do terrible things. We are ordinary people. We are not enlightened people. So for that reason, I think evil is a very good word to use. It really does express the spiritual state of someone who confesses from the very depths of their being, who is really sensitive to their unskillful tendencies, the unskillful forces within them. And the evil is really being revealed, the roots of evil is being revealed, shown, pointed out. The word for confession in Sanskrit is desana, desana, which literally means a pointing out. The golden light is pointing out these roots of evil within us, the golden light of reality. Just read you some verses from the sutra, just to show how, you know, thorough Ruchiraketu's confession is. And whatever evil, cruel act was done by me previously, I will confess it all before the Buddhas. Whatever evil I have done by not attending to my parents, by neglecting the Buddhas, by neglecting the good, whatever evil I have done by being drunk with the intoxication of authority, or with the intoxication of high birth, or by being drunk with the intoxication of tender age, whatever evil I have done, bad thought, bad word, by an act badly done, or by not perceiving a mishap, whatever evil I have done by the application of foolish reasoning, by a mind dark with ignorance, under the influence of an evil friend, or by a mind distracted by impurities, and so on. And a bit later, you get another set of confessions. The evil done in the oppression of existence, or through foolish thought, whatever severe evil I have done, in the presence of the Buddhas, I confess all this evil, and I confess that evil which has been heaped up by me in the oppression of birth, by the various oppressions of activity due to passion, in the oppression of existence, in the oppression of the world, in the oppression of the fleeting mind, in the oppression of impurities caused by the foolish and stupid, and in the oppression of the arrival of evil friends, in the oppression of fear, in the oppression of passion, in the oppression of hatred, and in the oppression of folly and darkness, in the oppression of opportunity, in the oppression of time, in the oppression of gaining merits, standing in my oppression before the Buddha, I confess all this evil. Extraordinary verses. And what it really illustrates is the total, full and complete individual responsibility that Ruchira Ketu is taking. Yes, all this language of oppression, intoxication, it's saying yes, in this conditioned life, in this conditioned existence, we are going to feel under pressure. We're going to feel squeezed by all sorts of difficulties, all sorts of circumstances. You know, it's understandable, in a sense, what's being said here, that we behave badly, that we behave unskillfully. But for the Buddhist, no matter what the conditions, what the circumstances, if you are unskillful, it is your individual responsibility. No one else's responsibility whatsoever. It's yours. And you have to do something about it. I don't know if you remember that fire under the snow by that Tibetan monk incarcerated by the Chinese in a terrible work camp under terrible conditions. He was asked if he felt fear. I think every day there was, you know, the possibility of tremendous cruelty, beating, killing even. And he said, yes, I did feel fear. The fear I felt was that I would lose the bodhicitta. I would lose the mind of love and compassion. That was his fear. You can understand him feeling angry. You can understand him feeling resentful. You could understand him feeling vengeful in that situation. But his fear was the loss of love, the loss of metta for his captors. That's extraordinary, really extraordinary, that sense of individual responsibility. There's that story as well of Mahago Sananda, a great Cambodian monk who went back to Cambodia after the genocide. There's a big meeting of all the Buddhists. Mahago Sananda was such a respected Buddhist, so many people there. Mahago Sananda's own family was completely wiped out by Pol Pot, and so many people there had suffered so terribly at the hands of this regime. And at the beginning of the prayer meeting, Mahago Sananda just started chanting in Pali over and over again, here in this world, hatred never ceases through hatred. It only ceases through love. This is the eternal Dharma. Amazing. Extraordinary. I bow with my head to these great men who live like this. So it's the same for us. There is absolutely no excuse for unskillfulness. Can understand why we do it, why we are unskillful. But for a Buddhist, there is this radical sense of individual, personal responsibility. This is the root of confession. I have done this. I have behaved like this. I confess this. I need to change this. In his lecture, Bhante says that when the golden light gets into you, there is a struggle between the golden light, the truth, the Dharma, reality, the Buddha, and everything that is against the golden light within us. Sometimes, he says, the unskillful states push the golden light out. But he says, when the golden light really enters into you, you can't get rid of it. You can't get rid of it. And you can have that feeling sometimes. You really would like the golden light not to be part of you. You really would like to give up on the Dharma. You can't. You can't. It's so inconvenient sometimes, isn't it? Especially having a conscience. It's really inconvenient. It's a drag, actually. Not really, but you know what I mean. I'm sure you've felt it. He says, once the golden light is in you, really, you're stuck with it. And it succeeds in throwing out, expelling the unskillful that's within you, the roots of evil within you. Bhante says in this sense, the golden light is like a sort of transcendental food, a powerful food, a powerful nutriment, or it's a kind of medicine, a powerful medicine, or he says like a transcendental emetic. And so that when you ingest it, it causes you to vomit up, spew forth all that hinders the Dharma within you. And when you're engaged in confession practices, if you're meditating especially on Vajrasattva, or you're doing a lot of confession puja, or just intensively practicing the Dharma, which is a purification practice, you can have dreams of vomiting up all kinds of filth, you know, within you, developing, you know, vomiting up shit and blood and pus and mucus and all the rest of it, or even parts of your body can come out. I remember once having a dream where I had this coating on my tongue and I was trying to get it off with my teeth, this horrible foul stuff all over my tongue, and at last I got it out and spat it out. And actually what I spat out was a great fat, white, disgusting looking piece of tongue. In fact, it was my tongue. And then I felt this lovely, pure, fresh tongue underneath it. And, you know, it was a sign, I think, of, well, actually, in that case, it was a dream, was the need for purification of my speech at the time. But you can have this sort of experience. So when we speak like this, actually, really what we're saying is, what seems to be going on with the confession section from the Golden Light, it's describing insight. It's describing wisdom. It's describing the effects of insight and wisdom. We tend to think that wisdom is, you know, once we're sort of wise and have insight, everything is sort of smooth and wonderful and, you know, we're sailing along very nicely. But when you really see the truth, there's going to be a convulsion. There's going to be a complete revolution. The Yogacara speak like this. They talk about wisdom, insight as the revolution in the base, or the revolution in the basis, the ashraya paravritti, the turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness, and the throwing out of all the negative seeds, all the negative karmic traces in the depths of your consciousness. It's going to be rare, it's a very rare thing, I think, to go straight to that level of confession. Confession of thoughts as wisdom, as insight. It's a process. And I said the word in Sanskrit for confession is desana, which means pointing out. So pointing out, I think, it's a really good word for confession. I think the word confession is a really good word for confession, because I think it brings out the sort of weight of what's going on. But pointing out is good too, because it implies that to confess properly, it's an accurate seeing, a clear seeing of your unskillful acts of body, speech and mind. You're really getting them into view. You're lining them up very clearly and accurately. You're able to name them. You're able to name what is unskillful in you, in your acts of body, speech and mind clearly. And you're able to get them out into the light of day, into your own consciousness, into your own awareness. And part of that is bringing them out so that others can see them. And when you do that, you can really go forward. Often when we're in conflict about confession, it means we're not really seeing the significance of what's happening. And it makes it very difficult for us to go forward. So this is very important, because confession isn't a sort of vague wallowing in failure. A vague wallowing in failure. And it's very different from this sort of Facebook, Oprah Winfrey, daytime TV, so-called confessional culture which we seem to be in, which seems to sort of encourage the self-indulgent and the sort of prurient. That has nothing to do with confession as a Dharma practice. That's something else. That's more to do with notoriety and celebrity and, I think, self-pity. It's got nothing to do with the way to enlightenment. I think this is where good friends come in. If we're wallowing in our own sense of failure and all the rest of it, well, you know, good friends just won't allow it. I can remember with Sangharakshita when I was doing some wallowing in my own problems after having confessed them. He just ignored me. He just gave me the Teflon treatment. I remember I was walking along a path with him in Italy, going over and over this stuff. And at a certain point he said, "Can I say something now?" And changed the subject, because I was wallowing. But I noticed as well, when I genuinely confessed to him with a real problem, a real difficulty, there was a response, a really clear, compassionate response to my situation. So then this brings us to how to confess. How, in the sense of what attitude do you bring to confession? And here, Sangharakshita says something very surprising. He says one confesses without any feeling of guilt. So long as you are feeling neurotic, irrational guilt, no confession is possible. And by guilt he means, he goes into it in quite a lot of detail, that terrible feeling of dread at the prospect of group disapproval and rejection. The group in its many manifestations, the religious group, the God that you no longer believe in, the family, you can feel very guilty in relation to the family, social groups of various kinds, near and dear ones. You might even turn what is actually a spiritual community into a group. So what I'm talking about here is any collective, any person who you are so desperate for approval from, so desperate for their love, so desperate not to lose their love and their disapproval, so desperate for that love not to be withdrawn, that you'll do anything to avoid it. That's what guilt is. It's that dread at the prospect of that rejection and that disapproval. I've known Buddhists, for example, who feel guilty about their skillful action. They feel guilty about their meditation, guilty about their generosity to the Dharma, guilty about their Buddhist life, because they hate the disapproval that comes from others, especially from their family, their parents, their spouses, their siblings, from their old friends. So we confess without any feeling of guilt. No guilt. No irrational, neurotic guilt. We confess instead out of our individual going for refuge. There won't be guilt, but there will be shame. There will be remorse. There will be regret. And I'm using these as translations of the Sanskrit words hri and apatrapya, especially perhaps hri. These states are very, very different from irrational guilt. They really do arise out of our faith. In the Abhidharma, hri and apatrapya, which can be translated as shame, and shame in relation to the wise, they're listed after faith. They come immediately after faith, which is significant. In other words, these states of shame arise out of our connection from the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Hri, for example, comes from a root meaning to blush. To blush. We do something unskillful. We're about to do something unskillful. We're in the midst of something unskillful. We see it as unskillful. We see that. And there rises up this sort of burning feeling. I am going against my most cherished ideals. I'm going against the Buddha. That's shame. Very, very clear. the very, very clear seeing of what's unskillful. It's the same word, by the way, hri, as Amitabha's seed syllable, hri. And of course, Amitabha is red. And Lama Govinda has made the point that when we experience shame, it's as if the Buddha is rising up within us as that sort of burning feeling. We're going against our faith in the Buddha. So it's a very skillful state, even though it's a very uncomfortable state, even a very painful state. And it's a state that people can sometimes resist. You know, you sometimes hear people say, they talk about they've done something unskillful, and they say, well, I'm not going to feel guilty about it. I'm not going to give myself a hard time. And there's a little voice that in my mind saying, well, you should give yourself a hard time. That is really unskillful. You've really hurt people with that. You should feel ashamed of that. You know, I might even say that to them if they're a really good friend. And it's sometimes they're using that language of guilt and all the rest of it to avoid what is in fact a skillful state. That sense of shame of going against the Dharma. This shows you that the ethics, it's not about rules, it's a sensitivity, it's a sensibility, it's even almost an aesthetic sensibility, you know, that it's going against beautiful action, if you like. It's ugly action that you're engaged with. I mean, the Buddha makes this connection between ethics and beauty. In the Dhammapada, he says, be swift to do what is beautiful. And by beautiful, he means ethical action. Perhaps I should just say something here. Sorry, this is going on a bit, this talk. About the use of the word fear, because that comes up a lot, doesn't it, in the confession verses, in our Sevenfold Puja and in the confession from the Sutra of Golden Light. There's this sense of fear, and terrified of suffering and all that sort of thing. And again, people think, hang on, what's all this stuff about fear in relation to confession? People are surprised. But you know, when you really see your unskillful actions, your unskillful tendencies, when the golden light reveals your unskillful tendencies to you, you realise that you're in a precarious situation. A very precarious situation. You've got hostages to fortune. And I feel that myself when I look at my own unskillful roots, you know, my tendencies to, you know, anger, ill will, craving, conceit, you know, all the rest of it. They are hostages to fortune. At the moment, I'm very sustained by really good conditions around me and the conditions I take up to practice the Dharma. But supposing those conditions change, could they kick in? I hope they don't, but they could. They're there. They're running on. I hope this doesn't sort of undermine your confidence in the Dharma. Somebody ordained for so long talking about like this. But I mean, it's true. So naturally, when you see that, you're sobered up. You feel sober when you confess. And yes, a healthy fear, a healthy vigilance in relation to those unskillful tendencies. There's much to work on, much to do. Sometimes I think that we moderns keep everything bland and mediocre and dilute and black and white and soft focus. We don't see things, I think, fully in 3D and full colour. We don't, for example, see sufficiently our incredible, amazing, mind-blowing potential and quality. We really don't see it. We don't see that we can be bodhisattvas and Buddhas. We just blind ourselves to our Buddha potential, this extraordinary energy we have for the good and the good that we can do. We just don't look at it. We don't take it in. The sublimity, you know, the nobility that we have. And we don't see how far away we are from that as well. We don't see the potentiality that we have to be a Mara, you know, to be a force for harm either. So we keep everything sort of bland and low key and dull, and we don't really sort of get anywhere because of that. In other words, we don't see ourselves as we really are, in our fullness, in all our glory and in all our gory detail. So don't really make real progress, and we end up very complacent. Very complacent about really pushing on into the Dharma really fully, and complacent about our unskillfulness. So we stay in this very bland sort of world. There's a wonderful saying of Sangharakshita, and I think he's talking about himself, but I think it could probably apply to everybody. It's one of my favourite sayings of his. He says, "I'm a lot worse than people think I am, and also a lot better." Often we can be concerned, I think, about the wrong things in ourselves. We're not concerned sufficiently about the golden light and what opposes the golden light, which is actually all that really matters. So when do you confess? Sangharakshita says immediately. As soon as you see something unskillful, as soon as you are aware, confess it. Name it. Offer it up immediately. If you're alone, just immediately confess it to the Buddha. There's a lovely story I read in that book, Forest Recollections, by Kamala Devanovich, which is a wonderful book about these 20th century forest monks in Thailand. And there's a monk in there, a bhikkhu there, saying that whenever he had an unskillful thought, he immediately did a prostration. And he said, "Some days I did a lot of prostrations." Beautiful story. So yes, immediately you can offer it up. And at the next opportunity you have, when you meet with spiritual friends, confess that fault to them. And of course, to do that, to practice like that, means keeping your vision, your purpose, always in mind. Always having the going for refuge there in your mind. The beauty of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Always keep in mind Buddhang Saranangacchami, Dhammam Saranangacchami, Sanghang Saranangacchami. Keep your inspiration alive. Keep the sources of inspiration alive. If you're serious about transformation, there needs to be an equal vivid awareness of the source of inspiration and what obstructs them. And the effects of confession, when you really do it, the effects of confession are ease, freedom, clarity, conscience, soft, tender conscience, brightness, joy, rejoicing in all that is good all around you. There is love, there is happiness, and there is much a greater sense of being close to one another. I remember on the ordination course in 1990, we had this. It was the first time we had a whole period of intensive confession on an ordination course, and it really was extraordinary seeing the transformations going on in people in these little groups that we had, confessing in relation to the 10 precepts before people were ordained. And people were saying that they were talking about things that they'd never told anybody before in their life. And one of the things that happened, there was this wonderful softness. People's faces relaxed. All kind of tension disappeared. There was a wonderful sense of sort of parity with one another. Here we all were, together, in the same place, working on the Dharma together. So there's wonderful closeness and a sense of each other's quality, real quality. There was that sense of, yes, the falling away of what was restricting the good, the Buddha potential, the potential for enlightenment, that started to shine more and more brightly, more and more beautifully between us, a sense of relief and ease. The Buddha says clear conscience is one of the fundamental conditions for successful meditation. If you want to meditate well, you need to really clear your conscience. Zhe Yi, one of the great Chinese masters, who's one of the figures on our refuge tree He says that if you want to make progress in dhyana, he says this in his book, Dhyana for Beginners, you need to clarify your conscience. If you feel guilt, if you feel shame, do lots and lots of puja, lots and lots of incense offering, lots and lots of purgation, lots and lots of confession to spiritual friends, lots and lots of sutra recitation, and examine yourself, look into yourself. Sometimes I think people feel a bad conscience when they really shouldn't. That some people can carry around a burden of sort of guilt, that they're a sort of bad person. And you've got to say, well, look into yourself, what have you done? And you might actually say, actually, today, I've just done really well. I've just been really skillful. Look at that action, look at that action. Wonderful, rejoice in that clear conscience. Feel happy in that. Build on that, move into dhyana. The Buddha doesn't seem to be concerned here with conceit or anything like that. Feel confidence in your clear conscience. Sometimes people have a bad habit of thinking badly about themselves. Well, that's unskillful. That's something to be purged. So yes, rejoicing. And in the chapter on confession, as well as rejoicing in living beings, as well as expressions of great love to all of life, the other thing that Ruchirakhetu does is praise the Buddha. The wonderful praisings of the Buddha after some of the confessional verses, really praising the colour of the Buddha, especially his golden quality, his mountain and heaps of virtues. I was going to read from that, but I think I'll leave it there. We'll do that tonight in the future. So thank you.